This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
All right, we are back. Thanks for spending some time with us this weekend. We do appreciate it, Dr. Mike O'Neill, with me now. Now we've covered a few things. We've covered budgets. We've gone over Medicare. Good grief, we've covered it all in the last few weeks. Very excited about this week as we address national and Arizona economy. Now, we've talked budget. Just define for us quickly, if you could, Doctor. Budget versus economy.
Sure. Budget is what the federal government, what the state government, what other governments do with your money. The economy and the topic of the week is really more broadly what's happening out there that provides the revenue for various governments and for all of us to run our lives.
All right. And with us today, we have two very special guests, Professor Dennis Hoffman. He's the director of the L. William Seidman Research Institute at W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Go Devils, fear the fork. And one of our very own joins us. So very excited about this to have Wayne Stutzer in studio. He is the host of The Smart Investor right here on KTAR. Welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, here's my really somewhat layman's take on what's happened with the economy. In 2007, 2008, we had a market crash, a housing crash. The stock market tanks in April of 2009. It reaches a bottom point. And it's since then gone up to record levels, at least until a week or so ago when things started to get rough. But we're going to ask about that. Unemployment is down now, though still high. The federal deficit exploded during the recession. It's now way down. Housing prices crashed, but more in some places than others, a lot more in Phoenix than others. But all those places like Phoenix that had the worst crashes seem to be on the way up more than other places. So the question first to you, Dennis, as the premier economic guru in this state, are we on the road to recovery now, or is this week's hesitation in the stock market, the time, sort of a canary in the coal mine of worse things to come? Where do you think we're going?
I look for better things ahead. I think the economy will definitely continue to improve. The question, of course, is pace of recovery. Are we going to plod along like some folks have likened this as a plow horse economy, just kind of one step in front of the other, just trudging along? Or are we going to accelerate, or are we going to somehow fall back into a deep recession or even a mild recession? My sense is that we're going to continue to improve. I think that in terms of likelihood, either acceleration or fall back to recession, I think I'd err on the side of acceleration. I mean, we've got a lot of liquidity in the system. We've got pent-up demand, a lot of cash on the sidelines. So we'll face headwinds, but I'm quite optimistic about the economy all in all.
Okay. How about you, Wayne? What's your take on that?
I would agree with that 100%. It's sort of like an economy that is steady as she goes. We would prefer to have more robust growth because we like, you know, we're Americans. We want to have results immediately. But in some ways, a lot of business leaders will tell you that this actually is better because it'll last longer versus the boom and bust cycles that we've experienced over the last 20 years. So, you know, it has more sustainability if it grows on a more firm base, which is on real money, not on the overborrowed leverage money that we just talked about with the housing market back in 2006 and 7.
Well, you referenced the housing market, and the solution to the housing issue seemed to be to pump more money into the housing system. Are either of you concerned about another mini bubble? Prices certainly have gone back up.
I am not. You know, in order to address that question, you really have to think about it from a bit of an historical perspective. We had a leverage on economy, both in the private sector and the public sector, for 20, 30 years, and it culminated in this big blowout in the middle 2000s that people talk about the housing bust. But when housing burst, the bubble burst, and people went risk off in terms of equities, and equities plummeted, household wealth just collapsed, and private sector leverage on became leverage off very, very quickly.
Want to explain your terms there?
Borrowing, just simply borrowing. Mm-hmm. Spending, the rate of engagement in the economy. So for years, and this is the baby boom generation, this is governments at all levels, were taking on more debt. Both private sector and public sector were buying goods and services, were accelerating at a pace that was perhaps unsustainable. All of this unravels really very quickly. And so government comes along, especially the Federal Reserve comes along, seeing this in the data. What they have done is aggressively sought to bolster the economy, be the only source of liquidity in the economy, and the only catalyst really to encourage spending would be the federal government and the Federal Reserve. And
basically, as I understand that,
yes,
that means the Federal Reserve poured huge amounts of money
absolutely
into the banks and loaned that out at almost zero interest rate.
And the intent was to inflate assets, to inflate housing prices, and to inflate equities. Now, you know, they're going to talk with you about getting liquidity to the system and providing stability and all that kind of thing. But the basic intent was to indeed bolster against this the ugly effects of deflation and price drops.
When prices, we all would love to see prices drop, right? Because, you know, I'd like to have a flat screen panel TV set that can, I want a 60 incher for $100.
Right. I like your style, Wayne.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm selling them, I don't want to see them drop.
Not that much. But the Federal Reserve is the lender of last resort. And as Dennis said, if they hadn't stepped in my opinion, during that whole do we bail them out or not bail them out, we would have been in the process of a depression. And what happens in depressions? Prices collapse. And it's much harder to get out of something like that than to get out of a little bit more inflation like we saw, let's say, like in the late 70s and early 80s. So I heads off to the Federal Reserve. I think that they basically saved capitalism.
And right there, that's Wayne Stutzer. You can hear him every Sunday, 8 to 10, on The Smart Investor right here on 92.3 KTAR. We also have Dennis Hoffman. He is the director of the L. William Seidman Research Institute at ASU's WP Carey School of Business. When we come back, I want to narrow it down a little bit. I want to take it national. I want to bring it down to Arizona if we could. Stay right there, folks. 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Economy, economy, economy. We have Dennis Hoffman, director of the L. William Seidman Research Institute at W.P. Carey School of Business right over there at ASU. And right from our very own tank right here, it is the host of The Smart Investor with Michael Dixon, I believe you're
yes.
All right, with Michael Dixon. This is Wayne Stutzer joins us. You can catch him Sundays, 8 to 10. Now, if you want more information, Dr. Mike O'Neill as well, you can go to MikeO'Neill.org. It contains a variety of articles, stuff Mike has written, and excerpts from TV presentations and speeches. Check you out. You're busy.
Well, it's not quite my day job, but it's my fun job anyway. So we're going to move to the Arizona economy. Now, first of all, if anybody lives in the state and owns property, you noticed there was a more than a downward tick in the value of your house. We got hit about as bad as anywhere else. And we're back up rather dramatically, though not to pre-recession levels. Our unemployment rate is down, though, again, not to pre-recession levels. In fact, over the last few years, traditionally, Arizona has ticked a couple of fractions of a point below the national average. We're now a little bit above. We're at 7.9, I think, last I saw, compared to 7.5 nationally. Both those figures are down from almost 10% at the high. But it's one of the things I want to ask about. Consumer confidence, we're up to May 08 levels, which is pretty good. Question to you first, Dennis. Is Arizona just the tail that's being wagged by the national dog, or is there very much going on in the state that's independent of national trends?
Well, housing, our exposure to housing really made us vulnerable to taking the brunt of the Great Recession. In terms of jobs, I look at overall job creation loss as opposed to the unemployment rate. And in terms of jobs lost, we're still down the better part of 200,000 people from the peak. Many of those employed in retail and in the construction industry and the support industries associated with construction. So to the extent that we're more exposed to construction, because we've been one of the nation's leaders in population growth, we're more exposed than others. We were very vulnerable to that I call the group that I call the investor locusts that swarmed onto the state in the middle 2000s. And by the way, I think that's a very different crowd than the current investor group. In the middle 2000s, they were buying claims on houses, not even actual homes. They had no plan to live in them or have anybody live in them. The people that are buying investor homes today are renting out, and there's actual families and individuals living in these homes.
And so, most of those are paying cash, right? A lot of those investors are paying cash as the lending was dried up after the bubble. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that's been an important catalyst in turning the housing market around. Now, a more normal housing market would have a smaller investor segment than what we currently have. But these particular set of investors, I think, have been good in bolstering the homes. They will sell these homes at some point, but keep in mind, there's people living in them. If they sell these homes to a new family that wants to move in, then you've got the existing family that's going to have to move out and find something else. And so, some people have talked about investors being a bad influence on the Arizona housing economy. You really have to sort out today's investors versus the middle 2000s.
Investors. I hear all this first focus on real estate. I remember what brings up to me is a memory of that 1988 Barron's article, you may recall, that Phoenix is a one industry town and that industry is growth. Wayne, maybe you'd like to comment. Do you think as an economy in Arizona, have we diversified much beyond that?
Well, yes. But before I talk about that, I do remember that article because it showed Phoenix, Arizona in a dust storm and said we have been blown away never to recover again. Okay. I would also like to say that the pre-recession level that you alluded to, Doctor, is a wrong way to judge it because the pre-recession level was La La Land. It's really not the norm. So when they say, well, we can't really see a full recovery until we get back to the prices of 2006 and 7, we should never have been at those prices anyway like that at that point in time. It was just overblown, over-leveraged. So I would say to you that you want to look back at prices more like around, what, Dennis, like the early 2000s maybe, 2003?
I completely concur.
So this pre-recession stuff, I would totally discount because we're not – some homes will never get back to those levels.
That's tough news for every homeowner who wants to believe that the real value of their home is that apex.
That's true.
That highest number it ever reached.
Yahoo, which in 1999 had $220 a share during that craze, isn't coming back to that level either anytime soon, if ever again. So, think about money, which in fact just today, for an example, the Federal Reserve has their quarterly report on the net worth of America. And we just topped over $70 trillion, put that in perspective, $70 trillion, that's net of expenses, that's called net worth. They do it every quarter, and that's the highest level in the history of the country. So in many ways, we are back.
You're saying, that's a staggering fact. You're saying that that gross net worth of the American population.
Net worth, not gross, after interest deduction.
After interest, okay. Yeah. Is higher than it was at the top of the bubble.
Correct. Well, you see, one thing about America, wealth is infinite. It's not static. It can get knocked down, but it then comes growing back. Now, it might not grow back to the same person that had it before. It might come to somebody new, like a Mark Zuckerberg. It might come to somebody who just bought a home in 2008, who has seen only appreciation in homes, not depreciation in homes. But on the issue of Arizona, I think that there is afoot something very exciting about the state, and that is education. ASU is doing a heck of a job. I mean, the downtown area now with the medical school and now the law school moving in down there and the Walter Cronkite School, which is one of the finest journalism schools in the country. Then you got Thunderbird Plus, we have an infrastructure now. When I moved here, we only had one road, and it circled the, you know, the city, and that was it. Now we have an infrastructure that's growing, a light rail that I love to see expand out all the way to Surprise to bring people into the city and all the way out to Williams Airport and bring it into that way, too. Hopefully, that'll happen over time. I think that we're more multifaceted now than we were when that article in Barron's was written at the end of the 1980s.
Completely concur. And, you know, the drivers of the economy are not construction and real estate. Our drivers are our base industries. That's electronics, manufacturing, aerospace, defense. To some degree, the injections we get from the federal government, some $65 billion per year, by the way, injected in here by the federal government. We've been a magnet for people. And so, therefore, quite naturally, if you're overly reliant because of that magnetism on construction, you're more exposed to it. But the key drivers to the economy are things that are more fundamental.
Well, I would think one of the things that may bring some of that back, though, the influx of people, is that correct me if you think I'm wrong, but when everybody got underwater in Michigan and Ohio and the coal country, they couldn't move.
Right.
And that's going to no longer be the case.
That's true. Well, that was part of the problem with why the economy has been taking so long to expand, because we were the most mobile society in the world, and that really took a hit, you're right, when you couldn't get around and find jobs other places.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Dr. O'Neill, I want to talk about budget, if we could. Once again, we just talked about the difference between the economy and budget. I want to switch to budget, both federal and state, when we come back. Don't go away, folks. You're in the Think Tank, 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Once again, an amazing show. We're going to switch gears here and head over to the state and federal budgets.
Well, we were talking during the break, and Dennis had some observations. What do you think, Dennis, is the most pressing issue with respect to the budget of the state of Arizona?
Well, a little bit of budget perspective. The revenue flow into the state's coffers has been really reasonably robust over the last several years. Of course, we had the temporary sales tax, but I'm setting that aside. It was an important source of revenues. But revenues have increased over the last several years. This spring was very good in incomes and in tax receipts. By the way, we talked in the last segment about the jobs we've lost. Incomes are actually back to the bubble peak in terms of aggregate incomes. And so I know people are startled by that, but they certainly are.
One interesting point I want to just pursue and let you get back to the main point, but do I understand you to say that even with the demise of the temporary sales tax, that state revenues will be up altogether, even without that, or is that not the case?
No, without the temporary sales tax, you're going to have a slight erosion in the total amount of collections, because the temporary sales tax was worth $1 billion for next year. So you'll have a slight erosion in collections. But I'm talking about individual income tax and some of the other taxes, if you compare them year against year without changing rates.
So the economy
is continuing to generate more revenue.
The economy is coming back, and that makes up a good chunk
indeed
of the loss, but
indeed
not all of it.
Indeed. The governor's plan with respect to Medicaid that's been widely debated, as everybody knows, is a very, very important piece of this puzzle, though. From an economic perspective, what I see is the governor's plan allows for an incredible amount of budget efficiency. And by that, I mean we have never funded in this state. We've never earmarked funding for indigent health care in any reasonable way, shape, or form. We've tried to finance it in the general fund across all taxpayers. And of course, it has grown dramatically since the early 80s. This particular plan, what the governor is advancing, is very efficient in the sense that it recognizes that the primary beneficiary in the economy of this injection, this massive $2 billion injection of Medicare support from the federal government, that will directly accrue to the hospital industry. Now, the hospital industry recognized that quite clearly, and in fearing that they might not be able to tap into it, offered up a hospital provider tax, a fee on their services. Now, from a budget perspective, it's far more efficient to align the costs of a particular policy endeavor like Medicare with the benefits, and that is the medical industry, the hospital industry. So it's budget efficiency, and to go down that path is very efficient. To do something different, to try to finance this across all taxpayers, is inefficient, and it crowds out other activities. It may actually end up, if you don't go down the Medicare avenue, these folks are going to fall into the emergency rooms anyway, and that's all going to show up in our insurance bills. So we're going to pay for it in insurance bills or in general taxes, or we're going to have the hospital industry take on the burden. I think the latter is the far more efficient.
Let me play devil's advocate on behalf of those who opposed it, who said, well, all this federal money is being offered now, but you know, there's no guarantee that's going to be kept up. And we may get sucked into something that we end up having to pay for differently down the road.
The federal deficit is an important long-run problem. People look at debt to GDP as a measure of the amount of debt out there is vis-a-vis the size of the economy. And people are in a tizzy today because it's north of 100%, which means the stock of debt is greater than the annual output of the economy, which is historically a very high level. But I have to point out, it was 122% in 1946, and we summarily reduced it down to 32% by 1981. It can come down if we have a plan to address it, if we have a long-run, sensible strategy that allows the economy to grow faster than the debt load grows.
But to the point I was making, I think it's a little bit off point, that the argument against the governor's Medicaid program mm-hmm. is that the feds are offering to pay for this right now, but that they may not do so in the future.
Well, there's no such thing as a permanent expenditure in the state of Arizona. There can be a recontracting on this. The governor's put in some clawback provisions, as I understand
it. It says that they'd be automatic even.
Right. But in terms of budgeting in Arizona, that's one fundamental rule. A tax cut, you have a tax cut in this state?
That seems to be permanent.
That's permanent. That's definitely permanent.
Because there's a two-thirds requirement and we never put anything back.
Right. But don't tell me there's a permanent expenditure on anything. I've witnessed that firsthand. It doesn't exist.
I love it. On the federal level, I would say that, you know, there's no such thing as a permanent tax code either, which we just saw as we were going over the fiscal cliff at the beginning of the year. But on that structural debt that we're talking about, structural, which really implies Medicare and Social Security, to me, it's still not in the debate why we don't look at it from a life expectancy table, because we know when these programs were put into place, and Social Security in the early mid-30s and Medicare under the Johnson administration back in the late 60s, we weren't living like we're living now. So I think that the structural deficit needs to be recalibrated into the 21st century.
Does that mean that you share Dennis's lack of consternation about that magic ratio of debt to GDP?
Yes, I do. And one of the other things that doesn't get mentioned is, we just mentioned it earlier, on the net worth. I would love somebody to ask one of the politicians or as a commentator to give us a book value of the United States. We know we have a $16 trillion debt, and we have now it's going to be under a $1 trillion deficit. Deficit's annual debt since the Civil War. What's the net worth of America? What's our book value in this country? We have a net worth minus expenses now in households and businesses of $70 trillion. What would you calculate the net worth of America is? If you were going to sell the whole thing, what would it be worth? I would tell you it's probably worth $200 trillion. So would you lend money to somebody who has a $16 trillion debt but not a $200 trillion asset?
I think one of the things implicit in that is when we often fail to talk about expenditures and to differentiate expense from investment. If we invest in a road or a bridge or something that we're going to have for 50
Correct.
Or 100 years, that goes on the books as an asset. And if we just give the money to somebody who spends it, that there's no long-term value.
Absolutely. And I don't think we really have to, you know, again, maybe this is simplistic, but in 1982, Ronald Reagan did change and recalibrated the Social Security system in the sense that anybody born after 1946 would have to wait until they're 66 or older. And why did they pick 46? They wanted to pick on us kids, the boomers. Well, you know what? There's another line that you can draw now, and that's the millennials. There are more millennials alive today than boomers. We had an echo boom in the 1980s. There are 85 million millennials out there today born after 1981. My point here is that draw another line. Anybody born after 1981 might have to not take Social Security until the unbelievably old age of 69.
Well, if we consider the fact that when Social Security was first implemented and the retirement age was 65 and the life expectancy was 64 and change, the expectation for the average person was that you weren't going to pay anything.
You got it. Or not get anything.
Not get anything.
Right. Yeah. So if you did that same calculation, you would say that you shouldn't be getting Social Security for born today until you're what?
I think
85?
Life expectancy is well into the 80s.
Yeah. So what you guys are talking about is a rational realignment of the costs and benefits of these programs.
Yes.
And that would be great dialogue.
And that is that's Professor Dennis Hoffman. He's the director of the L. William Seidman Research Institute at the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University. We also have Wayne Stutzer, who has joined us. He is the co-host, 8 to 10 a.m. right here on Sunday mornings. Of the Smart Investor. When we come back, Dr. Mike O'Neill and I are going to debrief all of this information that we've taken in. Hang tight. It's the Think Tank.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Boy, we've covered it all. Let me tell you, we've got a national and Arizona economy. We've talked about the federal budget a little bit. And I'm not going to lie to you, Dr. Mike O'Neill. You scare me a little when you say, I have an idea. We'll talk about that when the music starts. So I will give the reins to you. What is this idea of yours?
Well, here's the idea. First of all, here's the context. We are still in the midst of a sputtering recovery. We're coming back, but slowly. And stimulus is a negative word to some folks, I think, because stimulus equates with spending money on stuff we don't need. My idea, and I'd love to get the reactions of our brain trust to this, is the following. Let's lay out the capital expenditures that we envision undertaking as a society, say, over the next 5 years. And then, and in other words, these are things that are already priorities, things that we're already going to do, and recognize that we are in a unique situation. We've still got relatively high unemployment. Much better than it was in a couple of years ago, 7.9 in Arizona, 7.5 nationally, but not where we want to be. We've got zero interest rates, so we can borrow short term at virtually no cost. My idea is to take roughly the next 5 years of capital expenditure, stuff that we agree we're going to do, and front load it and try to do it in the next two. So that this is just not to satisfy the people who are concerned about spending, to say that has a trigger that ends when unemployment gets back below a certain rate, 6.5, 6.0, somewhere in there, that this is a stimulus, but it's a stimulus on stuff we're going to spend money on anyway. We upfront it now when labor is cheaper, when money is cheap, and where we have the need to still stimulate the economy, but we're not wasting the money on stuff that we don't need. I wonder if our brain trust could react to that.
I'd love to start off with that. A year ago, former President Clinton came up with a very interesting idea, and that is to create an infrastructure bank and fund it, not with taxpayer money, but with money that is overseas, the $1 trillion or $2 trillion that is parked overseas, not wanting to come back and pay 35%. Have it come back. Don't tax it. But you have to pledge, if you're bringing back any money, 10% of whatever you bring back to fund an infrastructure bank that would then do what we need to do over the next 5 or 10 years to bring the country back up to the 21st century, because our infrastructure, we know, is still 50, 60, 70, 80, and some of it almost 100 years old. And it wouldn't cost the taxpayers a single cent.
Let me just backtrack for a second and explain part of that. There's all this money, but this money that's overseas, you're referring to money that got taken overseas because our marginal stated tax rate for corporations is 35%. Corporations didn't want to pay that. They parked the money overseas. What you're talking about is a proposal to allow that to come back in under certain circumstances and tie that to an investment bank, which seems like a pretty similar idea.
It's like tether it. And actually, you could actually tell these companies that you'll make money on the money, because we're not going to just take it and not give you a return on it, but you'll make a return on it while it's there earning money as it rebuilds America.
But is the government, do they have a track record of making people money? I think from a commons, just kind of an everyday guy standpoint, who would run that?
I would say that private industry would appoint a board to run it in behalf of the American public.
Dennis, I wonder if you had a reaction to that or if you have a better solution.
No, this hits my sweet spot. I've been a shill, if you would, for infrastructure and infrastructure investment for years. My co-authors and I wrote extensively about this during the depths of the recession, that we needed to seize the moment. Now, when I think about infrastructure, I think about roads, bridges, but sophisticated communication infrastructure, water infrastructure in Arizona. I'm a believer in climate change. I think that Arizonans need to be prepared to be more adaptive to changes in weather that are probably going to be associated with higher, even higher temperatures than what we've been accustomed to. Infrastructure investments in natural gas technologies that would allow, say, diesel trucks to be converted to nat gas. There are huge numbers of infrastructure initiatives that we could undertake today. This would be the 21st century analogy to WPA efforts in the 30s.
And you still see a lot.
It's not work for public works sake. It's infrastructure investments that will yield long run investments. So when I think about financing, this is the perfect vehicle for debt financing at low interest rates. So I guess I would quibble a little bit with Wayne's suggestion. Even though you're bringing some of these dollars home in terms of some of our corporations, I'd like to see incentives in place in the tax code for those corporations to bring those dollars home and invest it in private sector activities and hold them accountable for making their own investments, paying good salaries, creating employment opportunities in their own right. We could, from a public sector perspective, embark upon this investment strategy or infrastructure bank strategy. Now, me personally, I'd rather align the benefits of that investment with the beneficiaries, and that's going to be all of us. I have no problem with asking all of us to pay for the benefits that are going to accrue from this infrastructure. Obviously, as you can tell, I'm not a politician, because I would ask people to pay taxes over the long run for those investments and make the case that it's benefits versus cost.
It doesn't have to be the WPA. I mean, Eisenhower built the infrastructure of the interstate highway system as a national security.
Absolutely.
And of course, it sort of sounded a little bit to me about almost like the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, which built itself around debt.
And all of that stuff is stuff that we're still using.
Yeah.
You used, Dennis, one word, incentives. Now, if I understand that correctly, that doesn't have to be a cash outlay. That can just be a break on the taxes on money that we wouldn't get taxes on otherwise, right? Repatriation.
Right. You create a tax code that provides, when I say incentive, what I mean is that it encourages businesses to act in a particularly rational way as opposed to trying to hide money legally, by the way, offshore.
Yeah, I think one of the oddities that I think people get confused on in the tax code is we have some of the highest stated rates in the world.
Right.
But our actual rates that we're paying, because there's so many write-offs and other things that reduce that to a much lower level, we're actually paying relatively low rates overall.
The effective rate. The effective tax rate for most Americans is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 16-17%.
What else should we do?
I would love to have smart schools. I would like to see high schools run more like colleges. And I think a lot of high school kids are there way too long. That's why a lot of them now are having by the time they graduate high school, they already have one full year of college under their belt. I really love what's going on with online education, which hopefully as time goes on will reduce the cost of education.
May put some of Dennis's colleagues out of business.
You know, we're prepared for. We're seeing innovation and productivity everywhere. I think that this is hitting the economy almost in every aspect. You know, for every four automobiles made back in the 70s, the productivity rate is four times greater today than it was back in the 70s. So in other words, it took four workers to make the same number of automobiles back in the 70s that it does today. So productivity is everywhere, except maybe in Major League Baseball umpires. I think you still get four of them.
So a wrap would be, Dr. Michael Neal, if you take all of this information that we've got, and it's been phenomenal information, how would you tie a bow on this one?
I see a couple of things. First of all, I heard an agreement on fundamental optimism about the status of the economy, that we are coming back. Granted, we are not coming back with a roar. We're coming back in a slow, methodical way. But that may, in fact, be good, because coming back with a roar often bespeaks a bubble that ultimately burst. The second thing I think I heard is ripples in the stock market on a week-by-week basis. I think I heard, don't panic. The fundamentals are there. And I think the third thing I heard, and an agreement on both of our guests, is that we ought to put more emphasis on long-term investment in things like infrastructure, which is not just roads and bridges, but a whole lot of things that are going to be around in a generation.
And some education as well.
That's part of it.
All right. We want to thank our very special guest, Dennis L. Hoffman. He's the director of the L. William Seidman Research Institute at the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University. And Wayne Stutzer, who you can hear every Sunday from 8 to 10 right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. This is The Think Tank with Mike Russell and Dr. Mike O'Neill. Have a great weekend, everyone.